From the States, Mr. Roy Wilkins. Proceed.
All right. You were saying a moment ago between tapes that you recognize this problem of the white man's problem of his attitude. How can he make himself acceptable? Or the fact that a Negro or some Negroes can find no attitude acceptable. The problem, what can be done to pass the test, the word you use?
Yes. Yes.
Let's go back to that a moment.
Yes. I don't know whether I would choose the word acceptable because it implies, it seems to me, that the Negro is imposing a test on white people for a particular reason, and that he must conform to certain criteria in order to be accepted. But
don't some Negroes do that?
Well, some do.
Statements in the press.
Some do. And but of course, I feel, Mr. Warren, we ought to recognize that in the present state of Negro-white relations, and the scramble and that's going on to get on record and to be understood and to be uncompromising and to be militant and to be demanding and to be all the things that are now regarded as the things that you have to be. People say a lot of things in public about white people have to conform to this, white people must give up, white people must recognize, white people must. This is a sure way to get on television, to get quoted, and to cause tremors in some quarters, or at least, if not tremors, head-scratching and soul-searching. But I believe, as I said on the other tape, that the Negro must recognize that there must be some sincere white people interested in the liberal cause and in the cause of freedom, irrespective of whether race is involved or not. They have given too much blood and made too many sacrifices for the right of freedom of religion, for the right of a trial by jury, for the right of to vote and have the kind of government that will represent their views, for freedom of the press, and for all the things that they hold dear. They have fought for these things, bled for them, and died for them. And if they now step forward and say, we want to include in our beliefs also the belief in Negro equality, or equality of opportunity for the Negro, or placing the tent of the Constitution over our Negro citizens, if they now step forward and want to do this, I think we ought to examine sincerely whether they are opportunists or phonies or pretenders or Trojan horses or whether they are sincere. And I don't go with this idea of dismissing all white people as being insincere or trying to climb on the bandwagon or trying to make a point or trying to make a profit or trying to use you or this. Some of them are. Freely admit it. But there are sincere ones, and we can use them just as all fighters for the extension of human liberty can use all hands. Now, as to this other thing about ingratiating themselves and about the difficulty of adjusting themselves to their apparent haste to ingratiate themselves in the new movement, here again, I think we have to use caution. Because in one breath we are saying, one of the great troubles in the race question is the lack of communication. They don't know about us, we say. We know about them, we're so sure. But they don't know about us. Now when they come over and try to find out about us, why don't we teach them instead of saying to them, we look on you with suspicion. You're just trying to ingratiate yourselves. You don't know how to get into the Negro world. You're awkward. And we look down on you, or we laugh at you. Is this the way when you say the prime obstacle has been lack of communication and people come who want to communicate? Wait until you find out whether they don't want to communicate.
Is there some implicit resentment on the part of Negroes at the assumption that a certain percentage of the whites who want to identify,
yes,
somehow come as what Lenin called the pathology of the left? They're coming with some compulsive, neurotic reason, some insecurity of their own, something that drives them, so it is not a free act.
I think so.
You think of something of that?
I think there is.
Suspicion.
I think so. I can't define it.
But
I can't.
You sense what I mean?
Yes, indeed. I think there are people with access to grind other than the access.
Yeah, emotional access.
Exactly.
Money making.
Exactly. Exactly.
Condescension. But
that's right. They may have ideological access. They may feel that what's wrong with the world is that we need a new system. And if I can recruit the Negroes in their extremity...
They're the communists. I'm talking,
yes.
I'm talking about the man now who comes with an emotional need of some pathological order, you see, that must be gratified.
Yes, there are some of those, too. There are some of those. But they all show up in time. And it's easy to identify them sooner or later. The Negro can spot the genuine article. I'm only saying that he ought not to meet all newcomers with this blanket suspicion or blanket condemnation. It's easy enough to sort out the emotionally disturbed, let's say, or the political leftists or the political centers or whoever they are later on. But I feel that if he has a chance to do evangelism, he ought to do it. He has a lot to talk about, and his cause is identified with the best ideals of America, so that they're good for the white people as well as for the Negro, and he ought to preach this.
Suppose, Mr. Wilkins, tomorrow morning we woke up and found that the civil rights, a good civil rights bill, wouldn't be satisfactory, had been passed, and that there were fine enforcement agencies were in operation, and high employment was in force, laws about fair employment, and a reasonable, even a willing acceptance in general of this, and we had our schools all integrated. What remains? That's
right.
A long way.
That's a long way.
That's what remains?
That's a long way.
After that.
What remains, of course, is for the Negro to become, and the white people too, in the sense that their Negro development has been neglected. But what principally remains is for the Negro to make himself with this opportunity, with these barriers down, with the help of new legislation, to speed on the process of self-development and self-discipline, so that he becomes a contributing, a more contributing member of society than he is now. He now contributes, of course, but he assumes broader duties than merely duty within the Negro community. He assumes, if he is a successful businessman, he assumes what a successful businessman assumes for community development responsibility. And he becomes concerned with hospitals and health and traffic and profits and manufacturers and banks and all of the things that go to make for community and state and national development, aside from being a Negro. Now, this takes time, Mr. Warren, to develop this, because when you come out of a ghetto, not only a physical housing ghetto, but a ghetto intellectual and ideological. When you've been excluded from the mainstream of American life, it takes a while to find out how to function outside of the ghetto. I recall years ago when I was in Kansas City in the campaign for the community chest, the sales argument in the Negro community had to be what we Negroes get out of the community chest. This was the way you could sell it in the Negro community. You had to point to the various agencies and institutions and how you got something from the community chest in order to get $5, $10, $15, or $25 from them. Now, in the day you're talking about, it will not be sold to Negroes. A community chest or a community project will not be sold on the basis of what you get out of it, hopefully. But what can you do for it and for the community?
The sense of community identification.
Yes.
In a full way.
There are Negroes who now already have that identification in many communities. You find them assuming their roles and sometimes suffering derisive comments from their brothers on how they have removed themselves from racial life, let's say.
This is not uncommon, is it?
No, it's not uncommon. But it's not as widespread as it ought to be. I want to see more of them assume more of their community obligations.
Yes.
I think, for example, the South is one of the things the South has neglected is to estimate what this Negro can contribute to the South. He's there. He has talent. Why should he have to migrate from the South to exercise this talent in Chicago or in Pittsburgh?
That's true of a lot of the white population, too, though.
Exactly so. They have come away.
Exported
That's true.
Black and white talent of all kinds.
Well, they have come away largely because of economic, some of them, because of economic opportunities. They get bigger salaries in Philadelphia and Washington and New York than they can in Meridian or Dothan or in Panama City, Florida, let's say, or in Tyler, Texas. And some few of them have come away because they couldn't stand the climate. But the Negroes have been driven away not only by the drawing of better salaries, but mostly by the treatment. Now, the South could save this talent and help to build the South. It needs the Negroes. It needs their manpower. It needs their life, their laughter, their warmth. It needs their indigenous identification with the South. They can be a tremendous asset to the South. In fact, they are now. They contribute, however, through a screen and through white people. But they could contribute for themselves.
Some weeks ago, I was talking, among others, along the way, to Mr. Evers, Charles Evers.
Yes.
And I asked him why he stayed in Mississippi. He said, I think things are going to work out here fairly soon. I don't know what fairly soon is,
yes.
But he said, we'll have a settlement here that's satisfactory probably before you can get it to some other parts of the country.
Well, this is a...
He then analyzed it. This is a character.
Yes. This, Mr. Warren, is...
I wouldn't want to make a book on that.
No, this is the echo of a hope that has existed in many areas in the South. Years ago, a man said to me, the first breakthrough in the South will be in Texas, because Texas is more Western than Southern, and it's more individual, and as soon as they're convinced that this thing is no good, they're going to throw it over. Well, I don't know. It took Texas a long time to wake up, and they've made some progress there. But breakthroughs have been made in Atlanta, as we've just mentioned. Breakthroughs have been made in North Carolina. University of North Carolina has quietly taken on a good many Negro students without any fanfare. University of Arkansas, interestingly enough, without any lawsuit, without any bitterness, without any tension, admitted Negro students to medicine and law and opened up the university to them. And you haven't heard a peep out of Fayetteville, Arkansas, since who laid the rail. Nobody has said boo about desegregation, mobs, fights, arguments, committees, petitions, picketing, demonstrations, marching. You never hear it. The University of Arkansas has gone quietly ahead. Now, for Mr. Evers to say that he hopes this will take place in Mississippi, he thinks, is the kind of thing that we all hope. I wonder how it can happen as I look at Mississippi's resources. I don't doubt that there are white people in Mississippi who would like to see some changes take place. But I see a massive political machine in Mississippi.
One.
Built upon, strictly upon white supremacy and keeping the Negro down.
James Baldwin writes in his most recent book that the best testimony, the testimony of those who are actively engaged in the civil rights struggle in the South, is to the effect that the Southern mob does not represent the will of the Southern majority. Baldwin's statement.
Yes, I agree with him.
You agree with him on that?
I agree with him. I think the greatest trouble in the South, the biggest obstacle in the South, is not the so-called white rank-and-file man who demonstrates occasionally against the Negro. But it's the Southern political oligarchy. They're the ones that have the stake in this thing. And it's not only a stake of control over the Negro population as such. That's only incidental. And I think if the white population ever woke up in the South to the fact that the political oligarchy has used the Negro scare in order to perpetuate control over the entire Southern hegemony, I think we'd see a real revolution there if they ever recognized this.
As one Negro college president, said to me a few weeks ago, he was talking to a certain politician who said, look, I can't do that now. He said, if you can get 200,000 votes, I'll do anything you say.
That's right. Now, this is true. Now, the spokesman in the Congress against the Civil Rights Bill now, the senators, among the 19 senators who are committed to vote against the bill, no matter what happens, no matter what arguments are made for it, no matter. Among those 19, there must be a substantial number, I won't venture any number, who really couldn't care less if this bill passed, who really honestly would like to see it or something like it pass, but they don't dare.
Some Southern politicians have said this privately.
Yes. Well,
they got to be off the hook then.
Mr. Fulbright, Senator Fulbright, speaking at the University of North Carolina early April, was asked after his talk there by the students, why didn't you extend your attack upon myths in foreign relations to the myths in racial policy? Why don't you attack those? Don't you know that there are myths? And he admitted that more or less that he did. But he said very succinctly, if I attack those, I wouldn't be here tonight. He meant a senator, of course.
He signed the Southern Congressman's Round Robin.
Yes.
The
manifesto, yes. He signed it. He's done everything that a good Southern white senator is supposed to do. He's done everything. He's voted right as far as the segregation is concerned. And he has kept quiet on various things. And he's spoken out when he had to against the Negro.
How do you interpret this, morally speaking, and or otherwise, on the question of Fulbright's behavior?
Well, personally, Mr. Fulbright has been a great disappointment to me because he is a living argument against those who say that if a man has culture and education and contact and travel, he can't be the same as the man who doesn't have those things?
Now, I asked Mr. Nevins, Alan Nevins,
yes,
known for some years, right after this book, he signed this thing. What do you make of this? He said he couldn't do otherwise. He had no right to do otherwise. He'd been self-indulgent. He can't afford to commit suicide and put an inferior man in his position. He's needed. Now, Mr. Nevins' views on the race question and so forth, you know what they are.
Yes.
He's not... This is a complicated remark, it seems to me, coming from him.
Yes, it is. But you see, I feel that a Rhodes Scholar and a university president and a man of the scholarship and breadth of vision of Mr. Fulbright, and I take nothing from him in those areas, a man who knows the world, who knows that this little peanut policy of racial oppression can't stand. He knows that. He knows it's demeaning. He knows it's irritating. And if he had a free choice, if he were a free man, he might not get out and crusade against it, but he certainly wouldn't have no part in sustaining it.
You think he should have committed political suicide and been an example then on the issue?
I don't know that he should have done that, Mr. Warren, but I do know this.
It would have been political suicide.
It would have been if he had come out. And yet, somebody's got to commit political suicide in order to drive home this thing. But nevertheless, I don't know whether I want him to make that sacrifice or not.
That's Mr. Nevins' point.
Yes, I don't know whether I want him, but I do think this. I think he might be more of a spokesman for what is euphoniously called the moderate point of view in the Senate than he has been. I think if a man feels that he has to maintain himself despite all the crudities that he has to subscribe to, or has to maintain himself by subscribing to those crudities that he really actually doesn't believe in, then he owes it to himself to do some. There are men in the Senate from the South who have said a little word here and a little word
Tennessee.
There.
Tennessee.
Exactly. Now, Tennessee, Ralph Yarborough in Texas. And you've had some remarks from some of the other senators. They've been oblique. They've been tangential. But for those who read between the lines, or as I say, read upside down, and you have to read upside down when you read the Southern white politician remarks on the race problem, you can see that what they're trying to say, Mr. Fulbright hasn't done even that.
How do you define the moderate position, in quotes, in the South? How do you define a moderate?
I don't know that
you just used the word.
Yes, I did, and I don't know that. I think I was falling into the popular colloquialism. I suppose a moderate in the South is a man who is for change, who recognizes that things cannot go on as they have been, but who isn't for as much change as Roy Wilkins of the NAACP, let's say.
But strange enough, he's sometimes called a moderate, too.
Yes, I know I've been called a moderate. But I always reply to that the NAACP and our position here has sponsored the most radical idea in the 20th century. That is, the idea of eliminating racial segregation from American life. The idea of reclaiming from the Constitution that affirmation of status which is contained in the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. So that I'm not concerned particularly with these labels that the latter-day crusaders bring upon us. I remember the days when we were the only voice crying in the wilderness, and when these same Negroes or their like...
You still are NAACP still carries the greatest weight of opprobrium in certain quarters than anything you can name.
We get more cussing out than anybody else.
Yeah. And in Greenwood, Mississippi, for instance.
Oh, indeed. Not only in Greenwood, but in any state legislature in the South. Except
it's known, his point. You have
said it is known. And we are considered to be the embodiment of the people who want to change or overthrow segregation. And rightly so, because we have been I say to you that the Negroes who now, their prototypes in our day, would not join the NAACP, would not come with us because we were judged to be too dangerous, too radical, and so forth and so on. I think there's more to this question of the Negro than just fighting to level the barriers. And you have to bring some statesmanship or some thought, whether it's statesmanship or not, to the problems that accrue along with the fight.
Yes. You know the quotation attributed to you, NAACP, they, that is the SNCC Corps and so forth, furnish the noise, but the NAACP pays the bills.
Yes, when I made that.
Pay and so forth,
yeah.
And then other, here they go on tomorrow.
Yes, this was the speech in Alexandria, Virginia.
Yes, yes.
And when that speech was made, this was an accurate statement. We had just finished bailing out some of the SNCC kids in Macomb, Mississippi, who went off on an independent tangent of their own without consulting us, without plan, without anything. And then when they got in a $6,000 bail bond trouble, they screamed for old NAACP to come down and help them out. And it applied particularly, and I tried to do this in Alexandria, it applied to our unfortunate experience with some members of CORE in Louisville, Kentucky, where we were on a joint demonstration, which was billed, however, as a CORE demonstration. I wish I knew the secret of CORE's ability to get newspaper publicity. I'd like to hire whoever they have over there to come over and work for us. But we had a demonstration in Louisville, Kentucky, in which 267 people were arrested. And 255 of them were NAACP youngsters, youth people. That's another thing that sticks in our craw. Most of our young people have been involved in all these matters, but the credit has gone to other organizations. But anyway, only 12 people out of this so-called joint demonstration were identified with CORE. And yet, when all the shooting was over and all the hooping and hollering was done, we not only got none of the credit, but were left with the legal bill of some $5,000 or $6,000. Now, since that time, the picture has changed to some degree. When I made that speech, it was accurate and well-founded, and it was based upon not all of our unilateral experiences with CORE or with SNCC, because others have been happier, but these two things did stick in my craw. And it's a little tough to find yourself vilified and sneered at as a kind of a knitting old lady over in a corner while the revolution is being carried on by us strong men, and yet called upon to bear the financial burden. And so I was speaking to my Alexandria chapter for their edification and education.
I've heard the same thing said elsewhere by other people. For instance, I think she is the president of a local chapter in Bridgeport, Dr. King's rally there a few
yeah.
weeks ago, by waiting for him to turn from heart, but a lot of speeches in between.
Yeah.
If, unless I'm mistaken, she was a lady who was speaking.
Yeah.
And NAACP was in tonight, was here in 23 and 33 and 43 and 53, and here in 63, you know, this
yes.
same. Notion. What about Lomax's analysis of NAACP in his book?
I don't.
Both.
I strange to say, I haven't read it, Mister.
It's probably predictable.
I yes, but I know Mister. Lomax's position, if you can call it that. But I'm afraid I'm unable to agree with Mister. Lomax on any. Except very minor aspects of this whole business. I regard Mr. Lomax simply and solely as a recorder, as a writer, as an observer of the passing scene. who has made a very good thing out of it financially. He's written articles, written books. He's lectured. He has so many lectures. He has to go through a lecture agency and charge a regular fee. And he says sensational things and challenging things and frightening things to titillate his audiences and earn his fees. And in so doing, he has made several references to the NAACP. And his analysis of our role is totally and completely inadequate because it was based on his own personal subjective estimate and not upon records. He has never been here and consulted any records that we have. And I'm afraid that I would have to discount sharply his estimate of the NAACP's role.
I was thinking his analysis of the structural organization, of the organization NAACP and its relation to main authority to general authority, the lack of a democratic organization, one of the charges he brings against it, of course.
Oh, one.
That,
this, of course, is absolutely...
One of the many, of course.
Yeah, well, this is absolutely nonsensical. The only organization that has a democratic structure in this business is the NAACP. As a matter of fact, I think sometimes we have too much. We are the only organization that elects our own board of directors.